Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset, your source for news in Chicago and beyond. Half a million people in Puerto Rico still don't have power or water, 3 days after Hurricane Fiona slammed into the island. In the coming weeks, scientists will be studying data from the storm to determine what role climate change played. But we know that a warming planet is causing more intense storms and extreme weather. And that weather is forcing millions of people, many of them already struggling, to flee their homes around the world. It's a future scientists have warned about for years, and it's happening now. So what comes next and how do we prepare? Here to discuss is Juan de Clay Barreto, Senior Social Scientist for Climate Vulnerability for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Also with us is Gaia Vince, author of Nomad Century, How Climate Migration Will Reshape Our World. Juan, how does the worst of climate change heighten the divide between the haves and the have-nots?
Well, climate change is clearly broadening those gaps that have existed due to multiple forces such as racism, discrimination, both in the United States and globally. We have seen that climate change, in the case of Puerto Rico, for example, has strengthened many different hurricanes, namely Hurricane Maria. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little premature to say what the specific impact of climate change has been on Hurricane Fiona, but certainly the characteristics of that hurricane, such as rapid intensification, slower translation speed, more rain and more wind are the hallmarks of climate change augmented extreme weather events.
Yeah. When can you be specific? Where are we seeing the most people impacted, would you say? And what parts of climate change are we seeing people affected by right now?
Well, across a host of different climate impacts, if you're talking about drought, if you're talking about extreme weather events, or I'm sorry, waves, hurricanes, floods, and so on. The common denominator in that in the United States is that it's mostly people of color and people with low incomes. We're seeing those impacts across farm working communities in many areas of California that are seeing extreme heat compromise their ability to work, mm-hmm. and their health, their safety. We're seeing across the U.S. Gulf Coast with many communities, including many indigenous communities, that are facing sea level rise and hurricane impacts, as well as the U.S. Caribbean. We're seeing heat waves all across urban environments, urban areas and rural areas where many populations of color live and many populations with low incomes with limited access to health care, preventative health care, air conditioning with a significant energy burden in their households and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty broad.
Yeah. Well, let's focus on Hurricane Fiona for just a moment, Juan. We know climate change isn't actually the full story there, and that climate scientists, as I mentioned, they still need to analyze all the data. I'm curious your impression, though. Do you think that climate change is at play here?
Well, certainly climate change is one of the big factors that are framing how much more strong these impacts or these hurricanes can get and can be. But it's also, like you said, it's not the full picture.
Yeah.
We have Hurricane Fiona landed on Puerto Rico, 1 day shy of the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Maria in 2017. And what we are seeing is that many of the lessons from Hurricane Maria were not heeded by either the federal government or the Puerto Rican government, where the insistence on not rebuilding the electric grid in a way that would be resilient to future climate impacts and to wean ourselves away from fossil fuels that make territories, island territories, more vulnerable to the price volatility of fossil fuels in the global markets, and also to the fact that those large power plants in Puerto Rico are located in coastal areas, plus a failure to develop or restore a transportation and mm-hmm. urban infrastructure that could withstand those historical amounts of rainwater, paints a picture that it's the combination of climate change with a deal of mismanagement and lack to in an unwillingness to recognize and tackle the climate crisis problem.
Gaia, let's bring you in here. When we talk about climate change, we often talk about adapting to it, right? So can you remind us what that means? What is adapting to climate change? And at what point are people just not able to adapt anymore where they live and they just have to move?
Yeah, of course. So as one said, you know, climate change is a threat multiplier. So people who are already vulnerable because they're poorer or they're discriminated against in society or economically in some way due to their skin color or because they're migrants, various reasons, will be most impacted. And the climate is changing. The world is getting hotter. That means that there's a lot more energy in the system. So weather events become much more energetic. Storms are much more damaging. Heat is much more intense and lasts for longer. Droughts and flash floods can wipe away infrastructure. So we've heard a lot about mitigation, about the idea that we cut back our carbon emissions so to prevent the future heating of the planet and this terrible impact. We can't prevent what's already happened. It's, you know, we've already emitted a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. The temperature of the planet is already at least 1.2 degrees above the pre-industrial average. And we're seeing the effects in Puerto Rico, in Pakistan, across the west coast of the United States, across Europe all summer, China, everywhere. Now we need to also talk about what's going to happen in the coming decades. And for my book, Nomad Century, I really wanted to address the fact that for some places in the planet, they will simply not be able to adapt. So there are certain things we can do. There are lessons we can learn. We shouldn't be building, as Juan said, we shouldn't be building infrastructure, housing in vulnerable areas. I mean, in some places, there's very little choice. If you can't build there, you have to move. And that is mm-hmm. what we're facing in the coming decades. We're facing huge movement. There's a tropical band running around the equator, which is going to become increasingly uninhabitable. Also, coastlines, rivers, many cities will be at least part of them will be uninhabitable for at least some months of the year. People are going to have to move.
Juan, Maria was a Category 4 storm, and the Trump administration, if we recall, did not respond and provide resources to help the residents recover and rebuild. How did that impact migration from the island?
Well, I think the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Maria, the disaster situation, the humanitarian crisis that unfolded, and also the earthquakes that followed in Puerto Rico in 2020 accelerated a process of out-migration and depopulation in Puerto Rico. That had been that had started probably a good decade or two before, right? Whereas the Puerto Rican population pyramid has basically been inverted. You know, it's heavy at the top with lots of elderly people and persons of productive age or working age, such as, for example, my sister and her husband, for example, you know, have left the island to pursue a different life in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so that combined with also the nexus of healthcare professionals as well, the fact that Medicare Puerto Rico, Medicare benefits are lower than in the United States, and a whole host of other structural, social, economic, and political factors are leaving Puerto Rico very, very vulnerable with very vulnerable population. I haven't seen yet, after Fiona, a mass exodus of people in the airports to leave the island like we saw in the first immediate aftermath of Maria, but that doesn't mean it won't happen. It's still a humanitarian crisis situation yeah. that's unfolding over there, right? So it's a little bit early to tell.
Gaia, there's this history of the U.S. government giving temporary protected status to folks who come from countries that have experienced natural disasters like this. Do you know of this kind of temporary visa program existing elsewhere, other countries?
Yeah, I mean, there are many countries around the world that issue these. But, you know, what we're going to be facing over the coming decades is something much greater than temporary emergency situations. Yeah. We're going to face, you know, Puerto Rico is a tragedy, and it will issue forth migrants, some of whom will return, some of whom won't. But increasingly, Puerto Rico will actually become largely uninhabitable, as will New Orleans. You know, there are places, you know, globally, the number of people exposed to coastal flooding at the moment is around 250 million people a year. By 2050, that will be a billion. Wow. You know, this is something we are going to need to plan for, you know, by 2070. And this is within my children's, you know, working lives.
Yeah.
This zone of uninhabitability I'm talking about could cover 1/5 of the planet. And it is the most populated 1/5 of the planet. We need to plan for this. We need to talk about it. You know, I propose a lot of solutions to this, how to manage migration in a humanitarian way. But it's an economic issue. This is an economic issue.
Can you share some of those solutions with us?
Yeah. So in Nomad Century, I kind of lay out a manifesto for how this might work. And it really needs to be globally coordinated. So there are many options. People are going to have to move to northern latitudes generally. Mm-hmm. And that means to the far north. We're going to have to expand existing cities, and we're going to have to build entirely new ones built by immigrants, essentially, just as America was built by Europeans, a couple of hundred years ago. Mm-hmm. So this could be managed by a quota system of migrants. We could be looking at charter cities. We could be looking at purchase or rental of land. I mean, the United States purchased Alaska from Russia some. In the 1800s, the UK rented Hong Kong from China. These are all options. Yeah. If you look at, for example, Jakarta in Indonesia, which is having this problem right now, very dramatically, the city, this enormous city, is being flooded constantly. They are moving their capital to Borneo. I mean, that's one solution. So,
wow.
So people are going to have to find solutions to this, and we're going to have to completely change the way we talk about migration and mm-hmm. immigration. We're going to have to get away completely from this very toxic idea that immigrants are somehow harmful to our economies. The evidence shows they are not. These are people moving generally for work, and they move to where the work is. If we manage it properly, these could be new, inclusive, prosperous, healthy cities of the future, sustainable. You know, the next coming decades are going to require an enormous transition in everything, a transformation in our food, our energy systems, our infrastructure.
Oh, yeah. A complete mindset shift, for sure.
Absolutely. For sure. And among that, we have to rethink how we move people on this planet, because migration is inevitable now. The degree is not, but it is inevitable. And how we manage it is going to set the next few decades.
Juan, you know, what role do you think people and companies and lawmakers in this country have when it comes to adopting more sustainable practices to just make the impacts of climate change less acute for folks in these coastal islands?
Yeah, I think that in regards also to what Guy is saying about displacement and forced migration due to climate change, while we have to talk about those impacts and how to manage, you know, the sort of inevitable outflow of people, we have to face the fact that there are communities, for example, communities in Puerto Rico that I work with, Afro-Caribbean descendant communities, who are actively challenging the notion that they have to move out of their ancestral and historical land, and that for them that only means that people with resources, with money to protect themselves and against climate change impacts, are going to take over those lands that are worth a lot of money, that have lots of natural beauty and ecological value.
Yeah.
And I am certain this is the case across the country and the world with other communities who are have a very deep sense of a cultural identity tied to the land, to where their social capital and their social community strength emanates from. And that is something that some communities are actively fighting. It's the case, for example, you know, FEMA at the federal level in the United States only provides money for people to go away somewhere else, you know, not to allow people to improve improve the areas where they live and protect them against climate change.
Yeah. We'll have to leave it there for now. Very interesting. That was Juan de Clay Barreto, Senior Social Scientist for Climate Vulnerability at the Union of Concerned Scientists. and Gaia Vince, author of Nomad Century, How Climate Migration Will Reshape Our World. Thank you both. This episode of Reset was produced by Linnea Dominic. It was mixed by Ethan Schwab. If you want more great interviews and conversations, then consider subscribing to this podcast. And don't forget to leave us a rating. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll see you tomorrow.
Ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.